Hello, my name is Bella Lapp, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I am joined today by Jacqueline Corin, Executive Director of March for Our Lives. Jacqueline's a panelist on the Clark Forum program tonight titled Organizing Against Gun Violence, Gen Z in Action, and she is joining me via Zoom for an interview this afternoon. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. So March for Our Lives is an organization that leads national campaigns for gun control and violence prevention. Feel free to jump in at any time. In the historic first March for Our Lives in 2018, an estimated 1.2 to 2 million people participated nationwide. The organization also provides resources to organize against gun violence and trains young leaders within the movement, like Jacqueline.
Yep, that is what we do. I co-founded this organization 7.5 years ago now. And there's been a lot of different folks who have led it, but I actually just became the executive director around 6 months ago. So it's an honor to have been, you know, an organizer on the ground and now leading a staff team that is supporting and equipping organizers around the country.
So earlier this year, I read that March for Our Lives had to kind of restructure its leadership and let go of most of the full-time staff, kind of condense the resources. So could you tell me a little bit about that transition?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, back in 2018, we had a lot of resources given to us. It was me and 20 other co-founders. And we were receiving a lot of money from people all around the country to put together the big DC march that you just described in the introduction, and all of the sibling marches around the country. So we had a lot of donations coming in. And, you know, when you're an organization that brings in a lot of money, but doesn't have as structured a plan for how to move forward. Sometimes, you know, foundations and operational structures are built a little lopsided. And, you know, organizing is a grassroots effort by activists in their communities. And it's also organizations with staff and budgets to equip and support those organizers. And so we, you know, kept giving money to support our organizers on the ground. But really, we over time started spending all the money that we had in 2018 and 2019 and not focusing on building a really strong fundraising strategy for the future. You know, we did bring in money, but we kept expanding and expanding and expanding without really considering, okay, what do we need to do to actually make the resources match all of the efforts we're putting out there? And it just came to a point, similarly to a lot of nonprofit organizations, especially advocacy organizations that are born out of crises. This is unfortunately a story that's not very unique, but we, you know, fell into this rut upon our 7-year anniversary, where it was a matter of restructuring and scaling down some of our programs and getting really, really good and sharp at a few things, or maybe not being able to exist at all moving forward. So we made a decision as a group to really focus on, okay, let's scale down for a few months, figure out our fundraising strategy, figure out the best ways to equip young people with tools and resources they need to act, and what campaigns we can run on a national scale, and then resume. And so now I'm at the tail end of that strategic planning process, and we are jumping back into equipping organizers on campuses and in communities around the country now, which is really exciting.
Thank you. So I also read a bit about March for Our Lives youth-led judicial advocacy team. Is that still happening? And could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So over the last few years, We've had young people, college students, and high school students come together on our staff to write amicus briefs, which basically means that when there is a court case that has to do with guns, and judges are faced with making a decision about, is this gun law in this state, legal and consistent with the Constitution. We want to make sure judges have all of the information possible before making that decision. And some of that information includes humanizing the issue of gun violence and those people who are affected by looser gun laws. So, some young people on our team came up with the idea of writing survivor-based amicus briefs that basically just, tell the stories of victims of gun violence, survivors of gun violence, communities that have been impacted by gun violence, to add color to the decision that judges are making. And we've been really successful and influenced those conversations in our judicial branch. We are going to stop those efforts for now because we're actually developing a great coalition with other groups in the space that are leading now leading survivor-led amicus brief processes. So we sign on to their briefs. So it's still happening in the movement. It's just March for Our Lives is going to focus more on actually bringing young people into the movement, and then organizations with more policy and legal capacities and connections are going to lead those efforts. So a part of our strategic planning process was getting smarter as an organization and also as a movement to say, March for Our Lives, you are the best at bringing young people into this movement. Let's have you focus on building resources to bring them in and tell them, three things they can do this month to participate in the fight to end gun violence. Or, Giffords Courage or Brady, which are two other organizations in the space. You have a lot of connections on Capitol Hill. You have a significant, legal team and legal center. Let's have you lead those amicus brief efforts, and we can bring those young people and March for Our Lives members into the fold. So they're not going away on a movement level, and we're still participating. We're just not the main authors, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Divide and conquer.
Yep,
Yeah,
exactly.
that makes total sense. I've also seen anytime students try to organize on this campus, a lot of times delegating and choosing, well, like you were saying, what thing are we good at and what thing can we do well and
Right.
like continue to do. I've seen a lot of students, myself included, struggle with how to find that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it takes a long time and often to actually strategize about how one group or one person can best contribute. It requires actually stopping the work for a moment because when you're going and going and going, and the gun violence prevention movement and GVP organizing is very reactive. It is always responding to shooting after shooting. And you have to take a step back to say, okay, this is something that's going to be a long-term fight. We can't do everything. What can we do best? Like you said. So, yeah, I mean, this is a lesson that I'm going to take with me in so many dimensions of my life too. It applies to everything, really.
Yeah, that really spoke to me. Everything feels like a very long fight right now.
Yeah.
But just focusing one thing at a time is very good advice. Thank you. Well, you already kind of spoke about this at our lunch with the students, but how do you feel about the Trump administration closing the White House Office for Gun Violence Prevention? And kind of what would you say to my initial response is just like dread.
Yeah, I mean, it is totally devastating. On a professional level, it's devastating, but also on a personal level, it's devastating as a survivor of gun violence to know that there were people specifically there to fight for me and other communities and people who have been impacted by gun violence. felt so meaningful. And to have that stripped away the day the Trump admin gained power was devastating, but also not surprising. And for anyone who's listening, for context, the Biden administration instituted an office in the White House focused on gun violence prevention efforts, and they were a hub for the movement. They, fought for gun violence prevention policy on a federal level. They facilitated a bunch of statewide efforts and federal communication to make sure those statewide efforts were, everyone around the country were aware of them. And they facilitated $700 million in funding to local communities focused on gun violence interruption and intervention efforts. That has led to the decreased firearm homicide rates in many cities, including Baltimore, for example, that lowered its gun homicide rate by over 25% in recent years. So this was a very important office. And also to have an office in the White House signified that the government cares about this issue and is actively working hard to end it. And to have it be stripped away, an office that is focused on preventing gun violence, which is the number one cause of death for children in this country. It's not vaccines like the Trump administration wants you to believe. It's not cars. It's not cancer. It's guns. And to have that be stripped away signifies a lack of care, a lack of prioritization, and a complete dismissal of the thing most Americans are fearful of every single day. So I deeply hope that the Gun Violence Prevention Office will be reinstalled at the White House in a few years. But for now, we're working on having states open their own offices of violence prevention. Many states around the country actually have their own. So, there is promise and there is a lot of work to be done on the state level. The federal fight is a little bit harder for now.
Yeah. Thank you. I was hoping you'd talk about that kind of transition into focusing more on state-based changes. Kind of switching topics a little rapidly here, but I read about Pam Bondi and the walk back on her promises to Parkland survivors that she made. So despite pledging to make, quote, every school in Florida much safer in 2018, which she promised in 2018, Bondi has used her new position as national attorney general to roll back on violence prevention. So in your opinion, what should we do to hold our elected officials accountable in these situations when they don't meet the promises they tell?
I think the best thing to do is what you are doing now, Bella, is to bring it up, talk about it, raise awareness. And in raising awareness of so many of our elected officials' hypocrisy and broken promises, we can actually make sure they don't hold positions of power in the future. And that's why, from the get-go, when March for Our Lives was created, we focused on civic engagement as well, because part of the fight to end gun violence is voting. Because we can do all of the advocacy campaigns in the world, we can talk about all of these things, we can do a lot of education, which is all very, very important, especially for culture shifting. But when it comes to passing policy, we can't pass policy with people who are receiving hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars in funding from the National Rifle Association, from the National Shooting Sports Foundation, and other gun lobby influences. So, talking about them, teaching your friends that your local congressperson took this much money from the gun lobby and has actively worked to prevent common sense gun legislation from passing.
Okay.
Doing your research, does your state senator take money from the gun lobby? Does your congressperson take money? Does your senator? And really just, holding them accountable by making noise. And that can also include writing a letter, calling them, and saying that you, as their constituent, does not you do not approve, and you feel offended, and you feel like your interests are not being seen. And the more people do that, and the more people actually understand the access that they have to these elected officials, because they truly, truly work for us. They are there to represent our interests, and a large majority of this country believes in common sense background checks, common sense, waiting periods on guns. There are things that we all agree on in large part, but are blocked. And so if people in office are not willing to, pass these common sense laws, then we're going to make sure we replace them with electeds who actually care about ending gun violence for real.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I also think it's, I mean, even I always catch myself thinking, well, what can I do when there's a lot of things that we can all do? Like, there is direct, like you said, people to reach out to. I'm hoping that's what a lot of students will walk away from the event tonight, with as one of their main takeaways.
Totally.
Yeah. I have two kind of shorter, lighter wrap-up questions. So the first one is, if you could wave a magic wand and pass one piece of federal legislation, what would it be?
That's a great question. I think I would give a lot of funding, in numbers in the billions, to local community violence intervention programs. CVI, community violence intervention, is such an important aspect of gun violence prevention. A lot of these groups do direct service work where they are on the ground in communities, and different programs are organized differently and operate differently, but some of them bring in members of a community who may have once, resorted to committing gun violence in the past, or are potentially going to in the future, and or are victims of gun violence, and rehabilitate them and help them, with educational opportunities, job opportunities. There are also CVI groups that do direct violence interruption. So, if a shooting is about to go down in a community, there are folks, really brave and courageous folks, who literally go to the scene and stop the violence as it is happening. CVI groups are enormously successful in preventing gun violence. Like I said, it's largely due to the CVI groups in Baltimore that reduced the gun homicide rate in the city by over 25% in just a few years. Baltimore used to be in the top 25 list of dangerous cities in the US for years and years and years, but now they don't hit it. They don't hit the list. And it's because of this. Because it involves community members helping other community members, and it actually tackles the root cause of gun violence. So I would say that's my answer. Honorable mention, comprehensive background checks and red flag laws and waiting periods on guns. But there are so many answers. And that's the thing, like, there are so many laws that come together to prevent gun violence, and that's why this is such a complex fight, because there's so much to do and so much to pass, and it takes so many people working from so many different angles to solve this problem, because really gun violence is a symptom of so many deeply rooted social problems in this country, and so we can start by these more like firearm regulation laws, like background checks, etc. But really, starting at the root with the work that CBI groups do can help us with so many other issues that plague us as well.
Thank you. I'm very interested in the whole community violence intervention space. I think it's really wonderful to be able to empower the community in that way. Like at the same time that you're, like you said, you're getting to the root of the issue. It's not some sort of punishment for violence or more surveillance. It's support.
Right.
Yeah. So I think that's all the time, all the questions that we have time for today. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed doing this interview, and I'm very honored to be able to talk to you about this.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm honored. I'm looking forward to talking at the forum later. And thanks to everyone listening and for your contribution to the fight to end gun violence.